Hey there, Dave Robinson here, and you are listening to Bench Talk, The Week in Science. We've got a special show this week. It starts with Professor Scott Miller of Maysville Community and Technical College telling us what we can see in the night sky during the month of April. He also tells us about the solar eclipse that's happening on Monday, April 8th. Then we're going to hear an interview with Professor Jesse Holland of the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. They spoke about science journalism. Before we get started, though, I did want to tell you something about this radio station. Forward Radio, WFMP 106.5 in Louisville, is turning 7 years old in April, and we are having a party to celebrate, and you are invited. It will be at Logan Street Market from 5 o'clock until 8 p.m. on Saturday, April 13th. Logan Street Market is a fun, locally owned indoor market square with dozens of small restaurants, shops, and bars. They're located at 1001 Logan Street, just a little west of the original Highlands here in Louisville. So drop by to say hi to all of the local WFMP programmers like me, hear some live music, learn how to contra dance, and meet some dignitaries. We'll also be ending our semi-annual fundraising drive at this party. Please go to our website, forwardradio.org, to donate to the station. We are a community-run, non-profit radio station, and none of us make a salary. Our only way we can pay to run the station is through generous donors like you. So, our fundraising drive runs from March 30th until April 13th, when we have our party. Please donate, even if it's just a few dollars. But anyway, let's get going with our show today. Here is astronomer J. Scott Miller.
April invokes thoughts of warmer weather. Warmer weather does tempt one to linger outside in the evening as the stars begin to shine. But starting out happens a bit later in the evening, thanks to daylight savings time. 8:30 is a good time to start, as it isn't quite dark, and one planet in particular might be seen above the western horizon through most of the month. Jupiter hangs low in the western sky through most of the month, but may be all but gone by month's end. Joining it on the 10th will be a thin crescent moon, freshly appearing after blocking out the sun back on the 8th. I will talk about this a little bit later. Constellations are easy to spot at this time because they contain bright stars with which to begin the hunt. Orion, Gemini, and Taurus are all considered to be winter constellations as they are high up in the southern sky during the winter months. But now they are tending toward the western or southwestern sky and have set an hour or so after darkness falls. Now the constellations generally referred to as spring constellations take the stage. Turning my attention to the eastern sky, the pattern of the Big Dipper catches my eye. From now until autumn, it should be easy to spot at some point along the arc of its path in the northern sky. The handle of the Big Dipper is notably curved. If one follows that curve of stars onward, one is led to Arcturus. That is, one arcs to Arcturus. Arcturus is the brightest star in the constellation called Bootes, sort of a kite-shaped pattern of stars lying parallel to the horizon in the early evening skies. The two stars marking the front of the bowl of the Big Dipper, the pointer stars, provide a line northward to the north star, Polaris. I note that, as usual, Polaris is the same height above the horizon and in the north, making an ideal marker from which I can find my directions in the nighttime sky. Polaris is at the end of the handle of the Little Dipper, a real test of how dark or light-polluted the skies are. Out away from city lights, the curve of the Dipper's handle extending away from Polaris is pretty easy to spot, as are the four stars that make up its bowl. At this time of the year, if you have dark skies to see it completely, it seems the Big Dipper is positioned to pour its contents into the bowl of the Little Dipper in the early evening skies. Below the Big Dipper is Leo the Lion. Its brightest star, Regulus, catches one's eye as one of the brightest stars in that direction. The back two stars of the Big Dipper's bowl can help us find it. Travel from the star nearest the handle and travel through the star below it and beyond. Regulus should be along that line. Above and to the left of Regulus is a sickle-shaped group of stars marking the head of Leo, while more to the east of it is a right triangle of stars marking the lion's hindquarters. Later this month, hopefully as temperatures become that much more favorable, a meteor shower should be visible, if getting out early is not a hindrance. Overnight, April 21st and 22nd, though more pronounced an hour or so before dawn on the 22nd, that is, while the sky is still dark, the Lyrid meteor shower will make its presence known. This shower may produce around a dozen meteors per hour near its peak an hour or so before dawn in dark skies. Unfortunately, the moon will be full, which places it in the sky all night long, reducing the number of seen substantially. So getting out perhaps a week or so before or after could yield some Lyrids. The big event in April is the solar eclipse visible on April 8th. On Monday, April 8th, a solar eclipse will be visible across portions of the United States. Much like the solar eclipse that happened back in 2017, the path of this one cuts across a narrow portion of the U.S. The central path will stretch from eastern portions of Texas up through Maine. For Kentucky viewers, the portion of the path closest to us runs somewhat parallel to the Ohio River as it crosses central Indiana. Those in the path will see the moon covering the disk of the sun. At mid-eclipse, the sun goes away and darkness levels akin to early evening allow one to look for stars or planets in the sky at that time. For the rest of us, we will witness a partial eclipse, the amount of covering depending on how far away we are from the center line. In the Louisville area, 98.9% of the sun's disk will be obscured at mid-eclipse. Close, but no cigar. Those in the Louisville area would have to travel north on I-65 to get in the path. Indiana locations within the path would include Seymour, Columbus, or Indianapolis. Do not look at the sun without special eclipse glasses. You can damage your eyes. But there are indirect ways that can be used to enjoy this event. In all these cases, your back should be to the sun, keeping the danger to your eyes low. The simplest method involves taking a piece of cardboard, the size of which is comfortable to hold in your hand. An index card will do, but if you have something a little bigger, that will work as well. You can take a straight pin and poke a hole through the cardboard. The downside to this is that you may not get a clean hole through which the sunlight will pass. What I like to do with this design is to cut a bit of a bigger hole in the cardboard, then tape some aluminum foil over that hole. If you now punch the aluminum foil, you may get a cleaner hole. It may be necessary to experiment with the size of your pinhole for the best results. Now that you have your cardboard prepared, you use it by standing with your back to the sun and holding the cardboard out in front of you. Light from the sun will pass through the hole and shine onto the ground, or perhaps even a piece of white paper that you can hold in your other hand. Changing the distance between the paper and the cardboard, or the cardboard and the ground, will change the size of the disk of the sun. Again, you might experiment with this before the event. A different way of achieving the same result might be achieved using a cardboard box, like a cereal box. In this case, you're going to cut out squares at opposite sides of the lid of the box. Scissors or box cutters, or a good pocket knife, might be useful. Over one of those holes, you can tape a piece of aluminum foil and, like the piece of cardboard I mentioned before, punch a hole in it with a straight pin. The other hole is for looking through. With your back to the sun, turn the box until an image of the sun shows up on the opposite side or bottom of the box when you look through the second cut hole. Again, since your back is to the sun, your eyes should be safe. If the cardboard is too dark, you might attach a piece of white paper on the opposite wall to make a screen to see on. There are a couple of even easier ways to view the eclipse. If you're sitting under a tree, you might look at the bits of sunlight hitting the ground. They may each show a bite taken out of the sun's disk while the moon passes between us and the sun. Again, don't look through the tree's leaves. Simply let them be the hole you would have punched in the cardboard or aluminum foil. Another simple process would be to spread out your fingers a bit and put one hand above the other. With your back to the sun, hold your hands out and see if they can produce multiple patterns of partial eclipse sun, just as the leaves can do. I even recently saw that someone used a colander, holding out in front of them while their back was toward the sun. Sunlight coming over their shoulder and passing through the colander also produced multiple images of the partial eclipsed sun. One site that you might consider checking out in preparation for this eclipse is science.nasa.gov/eclipses/future-eclipses/eclipse-2024. They have an overview of this eclipse, safe viewing tips where you can find directions to making devices like I suggested, maps of the path, and other resources. There are different links to click on to get even more information possible from them. Notice in all of these cases, I mentioned that your back needs to be to the sun. This protects your eyes. None of the suggestions I mentioned can dampen the sun's light to a safe level. So, do not look through any of these devices to witness this eclipse. The only somewhat safe direct viewing devices would be a proper set of eclipse glasses. And if you get those online, extreme caution is suggested. These are your eyes we're talking about, or those of loved ones if you get more than one pair. Or a properly filtered telescope, one with a proper solar filter mounted on the front of it. As to details, these are for Louisville, Kentucky. I will provide a link one might use for other locations at the end. First contact begins at 1:49 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. From this time onward, more and more of the sun will appear to be blocked by the moon until the point of maximum coverage. The maximum is around 3:07 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, when about 98.9% of the sun will be blocked. From this point on, less and less of the sun will be blocked until 4:23 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, the point of last contact. For more details for other locations, you might try www.timeanddate.com/eclipse/in/USA. There is a search box in which you can put in your town. If you click on the links to the eclipse itself, you'll be shown further safety tips and details on this eclipse. So please be careful with your indirect viewing devices. Then hold on to them for the next go-round in August 2044. The path of totality will be nowhere near us. You will have to travel up to Montana, North Dakota to be in the path. Road trip! So April skies have some easy things to spot. A partial to total solar eclipse, depending on your location. A planet still lingers in the western sky. Constellations up at this time of the year have bright stars within them to aid in the hunt, and toward the end of the month, a chance to catch a bit of space debris. All one needs to do is get up and out under the stars.
Thanks to Professor Scott Miller for that. Now let's hear from the National Science Advocacy Group, Union of Concerned Scientists. They produce a very nice podcast called This is Science with Jess Phoenix, and they've given us permission to rebroadcast part of their March 20th, 2024 episode where they interview journalist Jesse J. Holland. If you want to hear the entire interview, just do an internet search for Union of Concerned Scientists Make Democracy Work podcast. But of course, we'll include links to it on our iTunes, our SoundCloud, and our Facebook pages, too. Let's listen in now.
My guest today is Professor Jesse J. Holland of George Washington University. Jesse's work as a reporter, author, and TV journalist has taken him everywhere from the halls of Congress and the White House to the studios of C-SPAN. He's been a distinguished visiting scholar at the Library of Congress, and his work has been nominated for an NAACP Image Award. Jesse has reported on the most fraught issues of our times, and with the 2024 election cycle in full swing, he's well positioned to draw back the curtain on the role of journalism in an era where alternative facts and opinion hold more sway than data, evidence, and expertise. Thanks so much for talking with me today, and I'd love it if you could start by giving us a little background on what journalism was like when you first arrived in Washington and kind of compare it to the situation facing reporters today.
When I first came to Washington, D.C. in 2000, I came in at the end of the old school three martini lunch reporting style. The old Watergate style reporting was just ending when I got to Washington. The style of reporting that I was taught when I was in journalism school at the University of Mississippi and the style of reporting that you have to do now, frankly, post-pandemic, is completely different. Back when I started, face-to-face conversations were the only way to do it. Now people talk over video conferencing software, they talk over text, they talk over email. And those were ways that we would have never conducted business when I first started. But one thing you can say about journalism is that it always changes. But as long as we hold to our core principles of telling the truth as we know it and as we can prove it, I think the medium doesn't matter as much. As long as we hew to those principles, most Americans, I think, enjoy opinionated articles more than they do the old style who, what, when, where, why, and how. But of course, you can't have an opinion unless somebody tells you what happened at the meeting. We are being bombarded every day with a flood of information. I'm not even going to call it facts. Information. Some true, some not true. So it's becoming harder and harder for the average American to figure out what they should be listening to. Am I going to listen to The Daily Show or am I going to listen to the 7 o'clock news? We were lucky growing up where there was probably four basic television channels. You had ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS. Those were the only ones you had. And you were lucky if your town had a morning paper and an evening paper. So the silos for information that went to the American people were very small. Everyone had the same information because they didn't have options to find anything else. Now you have hundreds, if not thousands, of streaming networks and streaming channels. And the internet has turned everyone with a computer into their own media service. So it's harder for people to figure out who they should listen to. So sometimes that kind of information gets missed because there are so many options. Now, I'm not advocating for there to be fewer options, but I think where we in the media passed up on a great opportunity was when the internet first became popularized. Nobody taught media literacy. No one said, here are the things that are important that you should listen to, you should read, you should get your information from. So we're still playing catch up on teaching Americans the difference between disinformation and information. And as soon as we teach one thing, a new front opens up. For example, it takes between 20 and 50 years for Americans to realize that a certain thing can possibly lie to them. Let's go back and think about Orson Welles and War of the Worlds. Radio was new. So people thought everything they heard on the radio had to be true. And it took a while for people to figure out that, you know, everything on the radio doesn't have to be true. Well, along comes television. And for a while, people thought everything they heard on television had to be true. If Walter Cronkite said it, it had to be a fact. Well, eventually we figure out that there are people who can manipulate Americans through television. And we learned not to believe everything we heard. Then the internet comes along. And for a while, if you read it on Twitter, if you read it on Facebook, people thought it had to be true. So we're just now getting to the point where we're teaching Americans that everything you see on X, sorry, I said Twitter, everything you see on X, everything you see on Snapchat, it's not true. But just as we're getting Americans to believe this, AI comes along. That's why you see such an active effort from media companies to try to explain to people, just because you see a commercial with Joe Biden and Donald Trump hugging each other, doesn't mean that really happened. So we're actively trying to report on things that are going on and trying to advance media literacy and understanding at the same time. And frankly, with the volatility, I'll just call it the volatility of the journalism industry, we don't always do both very well, but we're trying, because especially with an election coming up, we're spending a lot of time trying to educate Americans right now that every video you see with a celebrity or with a candidate or with a foreign leader, all those videos might not be true. You can't just believe it because you see it. Now, just to be clear, you and I are not AI. Let's be clear. But there's going to be a lot of stuff coming up over the next few months as we go into a presidential election that we're going to have to double check before we believe, as the song goes, our lying eyes. Because just because we see it doesn't mean that it's going to be true. And that's an area that we in the media have to do better about teaching Americans. For me, that's the biggest change in journalism from when I came to Washington, that we actually are doing more of an educational part for non-journalists. When I first got to Washington, we just reported. Now we have to educate and report.
That is a tall order for anyone. We're seeing that in the scientific community too. Scientists used to be a little bit more cloistered away, and now we have to do outreach. We have to communicate. I wanted to talk a little bit about the omnipresent issue of alternative facts. It is a phrase that makes both scientists and journalists pretty queasy. How have you seen journalism as a practice shift in response to this subjectification of reality?
As I suspect with many scientists, there was a time where we thought our work should speak for itself, that we weren't needed as people or spokespeople or advocates for our industries because our work should speak for itself. And we've learned, and we're learning, that not speaking up for your work means that the people who need to hear it are only hearing from the people who are trying to tear it down. We're at the point now that everyone in their respective industries has to be willing to publicly defend their work. In the past, we would have said our work speaks for itself, either you believe it or not, but lies spread faster than truth. So if we allow people to just lie about what we do, it is going to color how people who don't understand what we do feel about it. You can't have only one voice talking about your work. Somebody has to be willing, whether they feel like they're appropriate or not, to speak up and say, hey, you know, I've spent years studying this. Here's what I think, and I can prove it through this information.
Things are changing. Newspapers are in some places dying off, and cable news isn't what it used to be. Can you sort of crystal ball for a moment and give us a glimpse of what the future might look like for journalism and how regular people are accessing and engaging with really critical news stories?
The thing I can say is that journalism will always exist. There will always be the need for someone to represent people at things that the people can't get to. There will always be the need for it. The medium will change. just as in our lifetime, it's changed from print and newspapers and magazines to pretty much all online organizations. Television is about to change with the creation of AI television hosts. If you want to really be impressed, go watch Channel One. Channel One is a new network that has all AI newsreaders. They don't have any human beings on screen. AI has gotten to the point where they can put an AI host and someone write the script, and the AI reads it just like a 5 o'clock news host would. One of the things that I see coming down the pike specifically is more individualized news. Just like today, we all choose our own entertainment. We don't just watch ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS. We now have all of these different streaming networks where we can choose what type of entertainment that we want to watch. Also, we all watch them on our own individual screens instead of sitting around a television with the family. No one's watching the same thing anymore. News is going that way, where we're going to all sooner or later be able to choose the individualized news that we want to consume. For years, we have been able to have a nationwide conversation where everyone knows what everyone else knows. Those days are gone. In the past, people accepted the news that was given to them because they had no choice. There were no options. So I think it's going to become more personalized. And just to be honest, I don't think this is a good thing, because I think we need to, as a country, all have a common base of information we're working from.
That was Jess Phoenix interviewing Professor Jesse Holland of George Washington University. Thanks to the Union of Concerned Scientists for letting us play part of this interview. But if you want to hear the entire interview, just do an internet search for Union of Concerned Scientists Make Democracy Work podcast. But we'll also include links on our iTunes page, SoundCloud, and Facebook pages. My interpretation of what Professor Holland said is that journalists and scientists aren't doing the best they could at drawing connections for the public on important policy issues of the day. They aren't fully describing the role of the fossil fuel industry in resisting climate change reforms, for instance, or the link between gun laws and the NRA and handgun manufacturers, or how the armament industry benefits from U.S. militarism. Well, if you listen to Forward Radio at all, you know that we are connecting those dots. So please donate a little money to the radio station sometime between March 30th to April 13th. Go to forwardradio.org to donate. And don't forget our 7-year anniversary party on Saturday, April 13th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the always fun Logan Street Market at 1001 Logan Street, between the Highlands and Germantown. We'll have music and contra dancing lessons, an auction, and a few short speeches from dignitaries. Go to forwardradio.org for more details. This is Dave Robinson, signing off for Bench Talk the Week in Science. Thanks for listening, and see you next week.